Hello, cinefans. I'm Kendall Kruver, and this is Watching Classic Movies. The two cinematic versions of Scarface were influential films which reflected their times, the 30s and 80s, respectively. Nat Segeloff explores their legacy in Say Hello to My Little Friend, A Century of Scarface, a fascinating book that draws on Nat's industry experience and considerable research skills. We talked about the effect these movies had and continue to have, the people who made them remarkable, and what it was like to meet Scarface director Brian De Palma. Welcome, Nat. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Well, thank you for having me with you.
So, Nat, how many books have you published this year?
I'm going to sound like Barbara Cartland with her romance novels, but since September of 2022, I've published 7 books.
Wow.
Now, that's not because I'm a fast typist. It's because even though COVID shut down the publishers, they didn't shut down my fingers. And so I've been writing for several years. One of the books, the one that came out last September, that is September of 22, from the University Press of Kentucky, is the biography of Sherry Lewis and Lamb Chop, which I wrote with Sherry's daughter, Mallory, who now performs with Lamb Chop. But that started 7 years ago.
Yeah, you had things in the works.
Yeah. So, one after the other. I published a book about my dog, Louie. That was the self-publishing because I couldn't find a publisher brilliant enough to want to put it out. But everything else is from publishers. So
yeah.
It's a lot of books. And that's why I had to ask which book we're talking about now, because
Well, and the Scarface book is so good that I'm like, well, he can surely handle this pace. It actually made me think about an old episode of SNL Weekend Update with when Dennis Miller was hosting, and it had a clip of Stephen King, and it showed him just typing. You know, he kept typing while he was talking. And then he had a moment when he stopped. And he's like, oh, writer's block. And he's like, oh, no, I'm good. And he started talking. And I said, that's Nat. That's Nat. So actually, I looked at the sketch, and it's not as funny as I remembered. But it's still that's you.
I'll tell you, I visited Stephen King and his wife a couple of years ago when I was doing some TV in Boston. And he was the first person I ever saw with an industrial strength laser jet printer. It was the size of a small college dorm refrigerator. And he would press print, and these pages just kept on flowing out. So I'm not sure that SNL sketch was necessarily a fantasy. He can really grind it out.
I mean, if it's something people want to read, then great. And I do feel like you're very seasoned yourself as a writer. You are in the habit of cranking out that copy and making it good and strong. And that is something that I really liked about the Scarface book, was that you it's entertaining. It has a sense of humor about it, which is funny, you know, Scarface, right? But you have these great sections about it, you know, this chronological order, and yet you have sidebars that go into all the details of it. But one thing I found really interesting about your purpose here is, while you do include production history, what you're really looking to do here is to kind of explore the effect of it, its place in Hollywood in America. So tell me about that.
Scarface, both of them actually, the one made in 1932, which was about Prohibition, and the one made in 1983, which was about the cocaine trade, really are documents, if you will, of their times, the times in which they were made, and just as urgent. Each of them, when they came out, they aroused a certain amount of controversy. But I like to write about the times as well, because when you see a movie, you know, you can watch one after the other, and they look like they were made today because we're watching them today. And the important thing with the public, and certainly with critics, is to try to view a film in the context in which it was made. And in Say Hello to My Little Friend, A Century of Scarface, I try to do that. I try to, for example, the 1983 version, which is all about powdered cocaine. It wasn't until 1984 that crack really surfaced in major American cities. And so not only did the filmmakers kind of dodge a bullet, if you will, because the crack and powdered cocaine are very different how they were handled legislatively and in the criminal justice system. And I wanted to chart that. So in the chapter, and I'm very proud of the title, A Few Lines About Cocaine.
Oh, I was going to congratulate you on that.
Thank you very much. I talk about the huge disparity in sentencing for white people who were caught with powdered cocaine and people of color who were caught with crack cocaine. I mean, until it was rectified some years later, people of color, especially African Americans, were being sent to jail forever, versus white kids in the suburbs who were given a slight tap on the wrist when they were cornered by the police with blow. And that's something that the drug trade in the 80s and the illegal liquor trade in the 20s and 30s really have in common. And that is they allowed the government to infringe on our rights, even beyond what the normal criminal penalties might be. So I found that very interesting.
Then you had prohibition in the 30s. So that's kind of what the Scarface was then. What was the effect immediately and going forward of that film, of the pre-code?
In the 1930s, they didn't have the code certificates, but they had the code. And this is one of those areas that nobody really studies. The Motion Picture Production Code was instituted in 1930 by the Motion Picture Producers and Distributors of America under Will Hayes, who was the head of it. That's why the censorship office was called the Hayes Office. But it wasn't codified until 1934 when a man named Joe Breen was hired by Hayes. And Breen declared that you had to have a code seal, which gave you permission to show the movie. They went over every script, every piece of source material, every inch of the film when it was finally finished. And they determined from 1934 on whether your film could be shown in theaters in America. It was a trade association, but it was still the law for the industry because they didn't want local censorship boards being set up by local blue noses all over the country. Well, the difference between 1930 and 1934 is profound. If you look at what we now celebrate as pre-code films, such as Scarface, Babyface, these wonderful movies, which really go out to the edge. Maybe someday we'll discover Convention City. Scarface was the one that faced a lot of trouble. Not only was it produced by Howard Hughes, who didn't really give a hang about any sort of laws anyway in those days, but the film had killing, it had abuse of police officers, it had the criminal living at the end. And when the code authorities came down on it, they had to reshoot the ending, they had to change scenes. They had to include scenes that have nothing to do with the story, where somebody is lecturing moral leaders in the community. It's clearly a pandering to the rising morality and outrage at the time. When Howard Hughes went to reissue Scarface after the code was being enforced in 1934, they told him he'd have to make so many cuts that he said, well, the hell with this. And he kept the film off the market for the rest of his life.
Oh, wow. He just would not play.
Howard Hughes didn't have to play. Now, he'd already gone through hell with The Outlaw, which, if you recall, was Jane Russell and her cleavage, which outraged everybody. He had done The Front Page, where they actually had somebody flipping the bird at one point. And in fact, in Scarface, there are two instances that a friend of mine who has better hearing than I wrote down where the F word is actually used in 1932, but it isn't per se the F word. It's somebody who mumbles it, but if you have a good sound system, you can hear it. And for those of you taking notes at home, in the 1932 Scarface, 34 minutes and 58 seconds in, and 1 hour and 22 seconds in, is where Vince Barnett, who's this, his character is called Stoop. He's a supporting player, supposedly there for comic relief. And he's working the telephones. And when he gets frustrated, he just tells someone to F off. In 1932, but you really got to be listening for it.
I was going to say, how did I miss that? I've seen that film so many times. But sometimes you don't watch closely enough when you see it so many times.
It sort of watches over you. That's very true. In fact, the only way that we were able to see Scarface, because it was considered confiscated, I'm proud to say, were in illegal 16mm copies that circulated among film collectors. And when I was teaching at Boston University in the 1980s, that's how I showed it to my students. We closed the doors, pulled down the window shade. It was almost like we were smoking dope. We didn't put a towel under the door, but it was close enough. And we ran Scarface, and then the print disappeared after that. It wasn't until the late 1970s that Howard Hughes's estate was able to license the film to Universal Pictures. They showed it at the Tiffany Theater here in Los Angeles on Sunset Boulevard, and that's where an actor named Al Pacino happened to come in and see it. And he came out of seeing Scarface, which starred Paul Muni, and Pacino said, I want to be Paul Muni. Pacino called up his manager, who was also a producer, Martin Bregman. They had done Dog Day Afternoon, for example. And Bregman called up Universal Pictures, which happened to own the rights to Scarface. And literally within the afternoon, a deal was set up.
Because it's Al Pacino.
Yeah, it's Al Pacino.
Now, did he have any attachment to the time period? Or was he up for the 80s cocaine update?
The original concept of the remake of Scarface, which was being handled by Brian De Palma and his screenwriter, David Rabe, they would later do Casualties of War together, was to do Scarface in the Prohibition era, which of course is what De Palma later did with The Untouchables. But they couldn't work out the problems. They couldn't work out the updating, and they couldn't work out any of the characters. So they kind of like left the project. They gave it up. There were some personal issues too, as we write about in the book. Then they brought it to Sidney Lumet, the great director with whom Pacino had made Dog Day Afternoon and Serpico. And Lumet said, well, why don't you set it in the cocaine era in Miami? And that was a breakthrough. So he started developing it. But then he wanted to make it far more political and critical of the justice system, which is pretty much what I do in the book. And so he left the project, and Brian De Palma was brought back in. And they used a young screenwriter who had only made one flop film at that point, by the name of Oliver Stone. And he wrote the screenplay for Scarface, doing some firsthand research, which he talks about quite frankly in his book, his memoir, Waiting for the Light, almost getting killed by some of the drug people that he went to. And he turned out this absolutely brilliant script that even today is a great read, even if you get the script on top of the film. So all these forces came together and made the 1983 Scarface a classic. And everybody knew it, but the film company.
Yeah.
That's the horrible thing. They released it and nobody came.
I just feel like we're just sleeping on Brian De Palma. Period.
I love Brian De Palma's work. And they were pitching the film to your nice white suburban people, I guess, but they didn't realize that it was the folks in the ghetto, the folks in the community of color, the ones whose aspirations were articulated by Tony Montana, the Al Pacino character, of rising from nothing and taking it now because you're not going to be allowed to get it otherwise. And it caught on within the hip hop community, and it has stayed there ever since. And it made the film quite a blockbuster after the interest was due on the payments.
It makes so much sense. You're in this society where you can't catch a break. Everything is stacked against you. Then just grab at success. This guy does. Mm-hmm. He street smarts, I guess, is what I would say. Yeah, he grabs for it because he will not get it otherwise.
It's like something they said John Dillinger said. Dillinger said, you do what I do if you have the guts. Well, wow. Tony Montana has the guts. He realizes a short life and a happy one. And he also realizes that the world is yours, which is, of course, the slogan for both films.
Now, this performance, I give him full credit, but I also think that Stephen Bauer is an MVP in this equation. Authenticity as a Cuban himself. Was he Cuban or did he have some Cuban blood?
No, Cuban German. Bauer is the German part of it, but his full name, which I do not dare pronounce. He's a friend. I don't want to mispronounce his name. It was very much Cuban, Hispanic. Well, that's the point. You see, Stephen Bauer was only making like his second film or third film, and he was cast because he was part Cuban. In fact, when he visited Brian De Palma before they did the audition, Stephen says, De Palma opens the door of his Venice Village apartment and said, so you're Stephen Bauer? You're not Cuban, are you? Brian talks like that. And he said yes, and he proved his credentials. But then they had some rehearsal period and a kind of a get to know each other period before the film started shooting. They went to Pacino's house in Malibu, which was far larger than the smaller house that Stephen had in Malibu. They'd get there every day for a month and they just pretend as if they were friends. And the way Stephen writes it in his beautiful foreword that he was kind enough to write for the book, he says, I taught Al Pacino how to be Cuban and Al Pacino taught me how to be an actor.
And you see that connection on the screen. It shows on the screen. That's what's so beautiful about it. He grounds the movie while Pacino's setting off sparklers.
Yes, yes. Stephen is something of a madman himself in a good way. He's done like over 200 credits since then. He's a pretty popular actor on television and movies, and he's one of the sweetest people I've ever met.
And that's a remarkable feat to be a working actor like that. So it's great that he's in this huge classic, but yeah, to keep going is really something. Okay, I want to go back to De Palma. I feel like he's so underappreciated. Why this comment he made? Why can't they review the film I made instead of the film they wanted to see?
Yeah,
that describes so much of his work. It does describe Scarface.
That saying, he told me that personally. I was his publicist for 2 days in Boston when he made the movie Sisters. He flew up from New York wearing his flak jacket, which he always wears, or a safari jacket, whatever you call it. And he brought with him this wonderful thing. He brought a loose leaf book with all of the artist's sketches for what was going to be his next film, which was then called Phantom of the Fillmore. It later, of course, became called Phantom of the Paradise.
I'm fiendishly envious of that, by the way. Go on.
Nobody wanted to see it. None of the critics he talked to. They didn't care, and they didn't much like the film either. And so when I had to phone him a couple of days later when the reviews came out, I read him the reviews, and he sort of sighed, and he said that phrase, why can't they review the film I made instead of the film they wanted to see? But I love his work. I like him. He's wickedly funny, very dryly funny. But when he's working, I'm told, he really is focused and is not that approachable. But his work, I think, is beyond criticism. I mean, he tries everything. It's elegant. It's operatic. It's cinematic. And he's one of the best directors of women since George Cukor. But nobody really credits him with that because women are often used as victims in his films. But that's the genre he's working in.
But it is some of the strongest female performances of the 70s. And the 70s aren't really known for being a place for strong female performances.
Well, you had Paul Mazursky doing Jill Clayburgh in An Unmarried Woman, and you had Woody Allen with Diane Keaton. But you're right, films at that point from the mid-70s on started being directed to her teenage boys.
Yeah. I think that something about De Palma I've noticed is he taps into people's desires, I think, a little bit, and it makes them uncomfortable. You know, it's sleazy to them or too sensational, but I really think that that's kind of how people are, and they kind of don't want to admit it about themselves, that they want to see all this blood and sex and murder. You know, I don't know if I'm on.
Well, you're right. I mean, people have done analysis of this. Films are essentially a voyeuristic experience. So you go in watching someone who can't watch you back. That's the principle of films. But as an exhibitor friend of mine said, a film will be a success if it makes you laugh, cry, scream, or get aroused. You know, make you laugh, make you cry, kiss your $15 goodbye.
Right, right. I mean, I think this is why I like genre. I'm always talking about this, because you can get political and get to the heart of matters, but you're also having a snorting good time. Mm-hmm. And he uses those genre mechanisms to make these really great films. Well, okay, I recently rewatched Femme Fatale, and it gave me sort of the same feeling of Scarface, of like, this is almost operatic in a way.
Yes.
It's just so larger in life. It's a movie. He's not trying to be real. He is making a movie and making it big and bold and larger than life.
Exactly. And people have criticized De Palma because they say he's another Hitchcock, which is a crock of it, because Hitchcock established a vocabulary that works with that genre. And Brian De Palma is simply using that vocabulary. It's like criticizing Hemingway for using English because Faulkner used it. Mm-hmm. That's the way you tell a story like this.
It's a framework. And I also would argue that there is a De Palma style, and you know it. You know what I mean? Like, you can watch, you know, Body Double and Femme Fatale and Phantom of the Paradise, and there are things that tie together that I would call a De Palma style. So this Scarface is just the ultimate, you know, De Palma film, because it shows both the disrespect and the high regard just stretched across time. So in telling this story, what surprised you? Because there's so many familiar legends and stories around it.
I was surprised, but only slightly, because, you know, researchers aren't surprised a whole lot. That is that, and I tried to pin this down with Oliver Stone and others, where did the line, "Say hello to my little friend," comes from? It's in the version of the script that is later, but it's not in earlier versions of the script. It may have been ad-libbed at the time. But that's not the way the line is written in the script. It's, "Say hello to my little friend here." But Pacino, when he gets into a role, just does it and channels everything. That's the one line that everybody remembers. And it came at the end of this long slaughter. As we know, the end of the film is quite, quite full of carnage. And it's full of carnage because when Pacino was handling the barrel of a gun in one of the earlier scenes in the sequence, it had fired, and even though it was full of blanks, the barrel was very, very hot, and it stuck to Pacino's hand with burns. They had to bring him to the hospital. And while he was recuperating, they had nothing to shoot. So they just planted squib on everybody and kept on shooting people to be killed. And so that was one of those happy accidents. In fact, Steven Spielberg was visiting Brian De Palma, and Spielberg even did a couple of the shots, although I don't know which ones they are. But that's it. You simply have to keep shooting. And they did until Pacino recovered and was able to come back in.
Let's just murder up this scene even more. Let's take it to the highest murder level. Sure. Yeah, I love that. So in comparing the films, what strikes you as far as the differences in the cast? Because they're all strong. All the major players in both of these are strong. But there are some kind of differences in how they present themselves and how the, you know, characters unfold.
Well, I'm going to ascribe the somewhat presentational style of the 1932 Scarface, where people are talking very loud, to the lack of sensitive microphones in the early days of sound recording, because these were all great actors. Paul Muni later distinguished himself, you know, the story of Louis Pasteur, Emile Zola, and all of these, that he could be more subtle. But in 1932, I think they had to kind of shout out the line so the primitive microphones could record them. And therefore, I think the 83 Scarface is far more subtle and far more interesting and far more dramatically involving. The other thing that is, and I guess this counts as a surprise, that leaped out at me was that in the original Scarface, although they're bootlegging, Tony Camonte, the Paul Muni character, never takes a drink. Whereas in the 1983 cocaine-infused Scarface, Al Pacino is hoovering everything in sight. So the old maxim, don't get high on your own supply, or don't get a head stash, or other things we used to talk about. That's the cardinal sin, of what Tony Montana does in the remake of Scarface. He is stupid, whereas Paul Muni is just brutal.
Yeah, and that's interesting because before you said that, I was thinking of Paul Muni as being the one who kind of had a sort of way of speaking, which implied a lack of intelligence, but it doesn't necessarily when you look at the way that he was running his business.
He's primal and like a child, because I think Ben Hecht, who wrote the screenplay for the 1932 Scarface, said these gangsters are essentially children. They have their toys, which happen to kill people, and they can do anything they want because no one's there to stop them.
Yeah. The 80s Tony, he acts like he doesn't expect to live, but his words tell me he does expect to get away with it. And I find that kind of an interesting contradiction. I couldn't really wrap my mind around what was going on there.
Well, it isn't like he was saying, Mother of Mercy, is this the end of Tony? You know, the end of Little Caesar. He is fighting all the way to the end. And the significant difference is that he's fighting other drug pushers and dealers, as opposed to the Paul Muni character who's fighting the police.
Yeah, that's true. And it's almost like he gets superhuman, like one of those horror movie, because he's so high in the end.
Yes.
Well, and shooting him. Yeah. That he really almost refuses to die.
But it's also funny. I mean, at one point he's snarfing it off his desk and he comes up and he's got a white nose.
Yeah.
And like Bambi in the snow. I mean, it's actually funny in a very horrifying way.
Yeah. It's the absolute worst, but he makes it like a cartoon, like he's Bugs Bunny doing this. Yeah. You know, the women in these films are also pretty remarkable. I mean, Anne Dvorak and Karen Morley, and then we've got Michelle Pfeiffer and
Mary Elizabeth Mastrantonio.
Why did I space on her? I love her.
Well, the women in the 83 version are far more evolved and far more interesting, I think, than in the first one. They're sort of there as ornaments. But Michelle Pfeiffer, who plays Tony's wife, basically tells him to F off and leaves him at the end. And she presumably wants to rebuild her life. And of course, his sister, played by M.E., is the tragic figure, as Anne Dvorak was in the original version. The relationship between them is somewhat interesting to describe, shall we say. Completely prohibited in the 32 film, although it's there, and far more explicit in the 1983 film. But they're both, A, terrific actresses. I mean, Michelle Pfeiffer, come on. Mm-hmm. And they have wonderful roles they can really chew on.
And this was after Grease, wasn't it? Grease 2. Oh.
Yeah, she was in two films before this, and she, I think, was surprised that she was even hired, because Grease 2 was not a big hit, shall we say.
And as much as, well, I mean, I saw that when I was 12, so I love it and I will always love it. But it's just interesting to me that she went from that to this performance where she just ups her game so much. You see what she is going to be in this role.
Yeah, she was so devoted and dedicated to it that she starved herself, because she figured somebody strung out on cocaine would be starved. And she was really put off because they had delayed some of the shooting for a while. And here she is starving herself. She said crew members would come up to her offering her bagels, saying, Michelle, you've got to eat something.
Like, you still have to do the role. You need some brain food, lady.
Right.
Another thing about, I mean, I will say, I love pre-codes. I love the 1932 Scarface. The fact that it's independent is evident, and I enjoy that part of it too. But the one that really has my soul is the 1983 version. That's the one where I always feel like I've been through an experience, and it always feels novel at the end because of how powerful it is. And part of that is very much the music. Giorgio Moroder, I thought it was really interesting that there was some talk about doing a version with hip-hop songs on it instead of his soundtrack, because so much of the melancholy and grandeur of it is his soundtrack. I mean, what did you think about that?
Well, it was a non-starter as far as Brian De Palma was concerned. Universal,
right.
Which was known for replacing soundtracks when they went to home video. What they did to Peter Bogdanovich's Mask is very famous. They pulled off the Bruce Springsteen songs and put on Bob Seger because he was a Universal MCA artist. And they wanted to do the same thing pretty much to Scarface. And De Palma said, no, that'll never happen. Because you make a unified film, and the film, the score that Moroder wrote for it is absolutely essential to the melancholy you're saying and to the driving forward of everything. If you make set pieces with music, it destroys the whole thing. And besides, there have been enough covers done by rap artists anyway, so that's
yeah.
Probably Universal was deluded into wanting to do.
I saw it as kind of disrespectful to hip-hop artists and that community. I mean, they like the movie, the whole movie. You know, why chop it up like that? It's really not giving them credit for liking the film, you know, as a package.
Who knows why anything happens in Hollywood?
Right. I know. Sometimes you just don't ask questions, do you? So is there anything else that you just love to bring out about Scarface that you want people to know about this phenomenon?
I'm mesmerized by Al Pacino's performance. More than just being a consummate job. You look at the way his eyes are, the way his mouth moves, the way he really is in the character. He's always on top of every scene that he's in. You know, he's always watching it. He's in the scene and he's watching it at the same time. And you just sit up close to the screen and you watch what Pacino is doing. I mean, all of the actors are superb, but I think Pacino especially is absolutely compelling in showing different levels at once. So it's an exceptional experience, even in 3 hours.
The thing that strikes me about that performance is there's so many choices he makes that you would think it would be too much, like the way he pulls his mouth down. You would think that would be too much, but it works perfectly. And it's so De Palma, if you think about it, that this is a movie kind of a feeling. I watched, right after revisiting this Scarface, I watched The Godfather, a little clip of it, and I couldn't believe the difference.
Sure. Yeah, people do their Al Pacino impressions, mostly based on Scent of a Woman, I think. But
yeah,
his absolute control, icy control in the Godfather films and what he's done. I mean, look at Dog Day Afternoon, look at Serpico, look at everything he's done. He's different, but he's still Al Pacino. One of the unsung Pacino performances, which I happened to find on YouTube before I think it was pulled off, he did a version of The Merchant of Venice, where he plays Shylock, which is unbelievable. It's the first time that I've ever really seen that play make emotional sense. And I'm including the version that Olivier did in the 1970s. Pacino is just beyond brilliant as Shylock in a film that hardly anybody saw.
I mean, this is a real actor.
Yeah.
Because you'll see people who are good and you'll enjoy him, but this is somebody who gets into the soul of things. He has such intelligence and such, you know, soul at the same time. I think that's what it really is. What makes a good actor is do those two things, you know, go combine in a great way and then have something unique to sparkle with. And yeah, he has it all the way. There's so many things about this film, about both of these films that stand out and are amazing. But he, to me, is really stands out as being an important figure. And a lot of it has to do with who Pacino was as a performer and as a person. Well, I really enjoyed reading this book. I'm amazed at how many books you've written. You know, I started The Exorcist book and I thought, wow, this one's good too. I mean, you know, I think that in the show notes, I'm going to have to share, you know, a lot of your movie books so that people can read them, because you really are so very good at this, at cranking them out and making them good. And I really enjoyed talking to you about this book.
Kendall, it's been a pleasure talking to you. I'm especially impressed that you watched the movies again and you read the book, and we're really having a good unified conversation here. So thank you for the compliment.
To learn more about Nat and his book, Say Hello to My Little Friend, A Century of Scarface, go to watchingclassicmovies.com. If you're enjoying the show, I encourage you to rate and review wherever you listen. And thank you for your support. This is Kendall Kruver, Watching Classic Movies. Until next time.